Next, we'll hear from, in the matter of R. Douglas Hoffman, Judge of the Municipal Court. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Michelle Michaelberg, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the state.
Your Honor, good afternoon. Good afternoon, members of the court. My name is Robert Ramsey. I'm the parent of the United States.
And respondent is next to you?
This is he.
You will have the opportunity, if you'd like, to address the court after counsel. And if you'd like to speak with counsel before that, we'll give you a moment to do so as well. You're counting on him addressing the court. Thank you. Ms. Michaelberg, please.
Please, the court. Possible, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
And you'll have the opportunity to speak after Mr. Ramsey. Last word goes to respondent.
Thank you. Let me begin by repeating some of the key words that the Advisory Committee on Judicial Conduct used to describe R. Douglas Hoffman: glib, defiant, contemptuous, and disrespectful. And that was after hearing respondent's own testimony during the 2023 hearing on charges that he violated the Code of Judicial Conduct. Ultimately, after considering all the evidence before it, the ACJC found that respondent violated canons 1, 2, and 5 by clear and convincing evidence and recommended removal. This case isn't complicated, and that's in part because respondent has asserted he accepts the findings of fact and misconduct in the ACJC's presentment. And what are those findings exactly? That on October 15, 2022, respondents entertained a subordinate employee at his beach home. There, they took shots of whiskey and had beers. And then after hours of drinking, respondent touched his guest in a sexually suggestive manner and without consent. The ACJC found that both the liberal drinking, along with the unwanted, inappropriate touching of his guest's knee and inner thigh, constituted ethical breaches. They also found respondent's demeanor when testifying to be flippant, betraying a palpable disrespect for the disciplinary process, and that he exhibited a lack of self-control, probity, and sound judgment on the day of the incident. Respondent had every advantage in the situation he created on October 15th. He's much older with far more life experience than his guest, but more than that, he was her boss and a judge, a position that automatically engenders respect and trust. And while respondent maintains that he was unaffected by the alcohol he drank that afternoon, his guest was intoxicated. Throughout that day, respondent crossed professional boundaries and exercised extremely poor judgment, calling into question not only his discretion, but his decision-making abilities. Since then, he's attempted to minimize and rationalize his behavior. During his appearance before the ACJC, he defended supplying his guests with so much alcohol by saying he assumed she, quote, learned how to drink in college, end quote. Later, when asked whether he sought permission to touch his guest, he was incredulous that he would even need to ask for consent before touching someone else's body. Reflecting a sense of entitlement and a failure to appreciate the problem with his behavior. Following the presentment's recommendation, this court filed an order to show cause and complaint. Because respondent did not contest the salient facts or code violations and said he would only be challenging the quantum of discipline to be imposed, he waived a right to a hearing. Yet, he continues to vehemently deny that the touching was improper and unwelcome. As to the sanction, he argues that removal is not warranted. Yet while respondent wishes to focus this court's attention on decades-old precedent and bind the court to the sanctions imposed in those cases, sanctions that don't reflect societal norms today, the state asked the court to consider more recent cases, specifically Russo, Falcone, and Obuck, the latter two of which also involved non-consensual touching to find support for removal. As social values evolve, the kind of conduct that affects the public's confidence in the judiciary changes. In turn, the legal standard changes. Therefore, it's neither novel nor unreasonable, as respondent suggests, for this court to enhance penalties for sexual offenses based on evolving attitudes towards those offenses, often born from a better understanding of the conduct's harmfulness. Indeed, ample support is found in the attorney disciplinary context for doing so. For instance, in Enright Cohen, a 2014 case involving possession of child pornography, as well as Legato, a 2017 case involving luring of minors online, this court imposed more serious discipline than previously for very similar misconduct based on society's changing views toward child sex offenders. In short, precedent, practice, and common sense demonstrate nothing precludes this court from recognizing the reality that judicial standards of conduct can change over time, and in fact, should change, and that relying upon older precedents inconsistent with contemporary values has limited relevance. In fact, because maintaining public confidence in the judiciary is the pole star of the judicial disciplinary system and the canons, it's essential that the standards change along with changing public opinion. And when we apply that adjusted standard to the totality of the circumstances here, respondent's conduct throughout the day, along with his refusal to fully acknowledge its impropriety, it warrants removal from the bench. Lesser discipline is insufficient to ensure that the judiciary and the public is protected from a judge who doesn't respect interpersonal or professional boundaries and shows disdain for the rules governing his esteemed profession. People of New Jersey deserve better, as does the judiciary.
Questions, anyone? Anything else you'd like to present? Mr. Ranty.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just wondering how my client or any other sitting judge would know what these amorphous evolving societal standards are and that he or she would be subject to them, okay? That years of precedent that this court has come up with over the years to guide us in these disciplinary cases would be ignored. I should have known something was up when the ACJC opinion didn't mention any of them, save for the Seaman and the Sobrian cases, notwithstanding the fact that I had cited them all in my brief. You know, this court has dealt with new disciplinary issues in the past. I think about, and I teach this stuff to lawyers and judges, and I think about In re Wilson, and Wilson, this 1979 decision by the Chief Justice Wilentz, this was going to be a disbarment case and calling for this invariable sanction in every one of these cases in the future. And Mr. Wilson, Wendell Wilson, would have had no idea that this is what he or people in the future were going to face when this came up. But as I teach my students, this was never going to be anything other than a disbarment case because Wendell Wilson had so much of the baggage he brought to the court that particular day, so many other open charges that he should have anticipated he was going to be disbarred regardless of the knowing misappropriation of client funds. The case really was explained better by the court in a case that came out a few years later, In re Hollandonner. Hollandonner was a situation that dealt with the misappropriation or misuse of escrow funds. And the court there said, we're going to apply the Wilson standard to escrow funds as well as client funds that are held in trust. But it would be unfair to Anton Hollandonner to disbar him on this occasion because he would have no idea that we're implementing this new rule of law. So they did not disbar him. They made disbarment prospective. And in his case, I forget whether it was a 1 year or a 2 year suspension, but he was not subject to disbarment because the court recognized that this is something that just out of fundamental fairness, people should know ahead of time what they're looking at if they want to get in trouble this way. There have been cases before the court where disbarment was sought in cases involving sexual misconduct. The one case that comes to mind is In re Witherspoon, where two judges of this court wanted to include a new standard of automatic disbarment, very similar to In re Wilson, in cases where lawyers will engage in sexual misconduct with clients, okay? Fortunately for Mr. Witherspoon, cooler heads prevailed and five justice majority said, no, this is not that type of case. And I think he wound up getting a 1 year suspension. So when I put this case together, I really had every right, I think, to expect that the ACJC and this court would follow its own precedent established over many, many years. And I cited all those cases in the brief. Only two of them resulted in removals.
One of them was a Russo case, and he richly deserved exactly what he got. The Falcone case would have been a removal case had it been litigated before the court. And I agree with the Attorney General on that. There's no problem. But all the other cases resulted in some other level of discipline, not involving removal from office. I'm not even sure that was on the table. The most egregious of all of them was In re Jones, where this Superior Court judge at a Christmas party got drunk and was groping all kinds of people there. I think there were six victims, five of whom were employees of the judiciary, one of whom was a private citizen, a bartender there. And the court took all that into consideration and suspended this individual for 4 months. And I have to tell you, by this court's standards, excuse me, 4 months is a long period of time. Typically, the suspensions of judges in Superior Court, they range 1 month, 2 months, because judges can't have any other income outside of their judicial salary, and the court doesn't want to starve them to death. 4 months was a pretty significant piece of discipline, and I don't know that actually any other Superior Court judge has been suspended for a period of 4 months. But that was the most egregious example I can think of, repeated groping and outrageous public conduct by a judge. I've been thinking about my client's case a lot, and I think maybe I made a mistake in how I approached it in my brief and in the argument before the ACJC, but especially I'm concerned about the court. I mentioned to you a moment ago, I teach this stuff to judges and lawyers. I'm the author of the principal text on judicial discipline in the state. And I ride around, I'm thinking about the case. I thought to myself, what about the cases where there have been removals of judges, from the municipal court bench or Superior Court bench? How do they stack up against the conduct in this particular case? And, I thought about it. And these are cases, to me, that just right off the top of my head, they kind of rank up there in the pantheon of judicial disgrace. Your honors will be familiar with all these things. I just want to mention a couple of them. Carusi is the case of involving bribery. Chief Justice Wilentz indicated any judge who does that is going to A, be removed from office, and B, disbarred. Imbriani, a very notorious case involving a Somerset County judge who was actually pretty outstanding judge in his vicinage, but wound up being criminally prosecuted and again removed from the bench. So criminal conduct has resulted in removal from the bench. There's other examples of criminal conduct that did not result in convictions, but nonetheless resulted in removal. And Ray Breslin, Pepe, a man I actually knew, had marijuana in his chambers. And Iacarino, someone who used a judicial office to gain favor on behalf of his daughter, as well as just completely disrespectful treatment of the attorneys and litigants who came before him. And finally, there's a series of cases involving the abuse of judicial power. Wolf Same is the most recent one that I can think of. In re Yengo, a notorious case back from 1977, involving just the most unbelievable abuse of people in municipal court. I think it was in Jersey City Municipal Court. The Russo case we just talked about a moment ago. In re Hart, 1977, someone who kind of rigged the court system to have a dismissal. Bolin, municipal court judge who exchanged sexual favors in exchange for favorable rulings in municipal court. And finally, In re Sasso, a case involving a judge, again, who was unbelievably arrogant, nasty, rude, and just completely tormented the people who came before him, many times appearing on the bench while intoxicated. These are the cases that merited removal from office. These are the ones where the court said, no, this is intolerable. The people of our state have a right to expect better. Now, what do we have in my client's case? There's plenty of ammunition here to discipline him. And I agree with the Attorney General. Everything she said, with one exception, is completely justified, true, and admitted by the respondent. He has to be subject to some level of discipline. This train that was going off the track should have been stopped at any number of times by stopping, letting her drink and get to the point where she was so unbelievably intoxicated that she was falling down drunk, allowing her to engage in conversations with him that were completely inappropriate, especially between a subordinate and her judge. The whole thing was just a complete catastrophe from beginning to end. On the other hand, my client has adamantly maintained and maintains to this day that he did not touch her in the way that was described. The closest he came to that was, and I think the ACJC made this finding, that he put his hand on her knee trying to comfort her when she was talking about something of a highly personal nature, sexual in nature, and was becoming upset by it.
Mr. Ramsey, we understand that the facts are undisputed.
They are.
So what is it that your client admits happened?
Your Honor, I will tell you, my client, again.
Let me finish the question. It happened in terms of touching. What is it that he admits?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I couldn't.
What is it that your client admits in terms of the touching aspect?
And on her knee to comfort her because she was getting very upset about something that she was talking about.
And the second
he denies. And this is what this court would have to find de novo beyond a reasonable doubt is that he slid his hand up onto her thigh. Okay. And that's really what the whole case comes down to.
Sorry. So he denies, I think I might have misunderstood. He denies that he touched any part of her body aside from her knee.
No, not true, Your Honor. Okay. He admits that he put his hand on her knee and that was actually comforting to her.
Yes.
Okay. It was the move from her knee moving up her leg.
I just stated he denies that he touched any part of the victim's body aside from her knee.
Correct.
And you said no.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but maybe I misunderstood your question.
Okay, so he admits that he touched her knee, but only her knee. So the inner thigh, he rejects also.
Correct. Correct. And he maintained that before the ACJC. So
this is the Q&A in front of with counsel for the ACJC. And the second Pat, what part of her body did you touch? Same thing, my right hand to her leg. It wasn't her knee, it was her leg. The thigh? Yes. Was it the side of the thigh, the front of her thigh, the inside of her thigh? You know, be more specific. The way she was sitting, it would be the inside, because you got to remember, I'm sitting like this.
Mm-hmm.
He admits to touching the inside of her thigh without consent.
Well, he didn't.
Do you dispute that?
Again, I'm not so sure that that's what he meant by his testimony.
That's what he said, and he has said to us in waiving the hearing that he is not challenging the facts
mm-hmm.
and the finding of facts in the ACJC's presentment. And the ACJC certainly found that he touched the inner thigh of a subordinate while drunk or being drunk without right. consent. So I understood that was not up for discussion today. You have a different position. You may
it's only for discussion to the extent that Your Honor would have and the other members of this honorable court would have to find that beyond a reasonable doubt at this point.
Okay. Which you've asked we not do, but have conceded there is enough mm-hmm. for that finding to be made. Is that accurate?
It's going to have to be. We've stipulated to it.
Fine. So there is no dispute then that he touched her inner thigh.
Correct. Well, as per what the findings are the findings of fact are, yes, we're going to have to go with that. We admitted right. to it.
Okay. Let's go with that then. All right. Please proceed.
Let us assume, arguendo, that that's exactly what happened. Okay. So then the question is, what is the level of discipline that's fair and appropriate in this case? And I'm suggesting to all of you, based on years of precedent involving improper touching, which I've outlined in great detail in my brief, and contrasted with some of the cases I've just mentioned to you where people were removed from office for egregious conduct, this comes nowhere near close to meriting removal from office. It's just not a removal case. This was something that was done momentarily in private. And none of that excuses it. Again, there has to be discipline in this case. It's just not a removal case.
In private with a subordinate who works for...
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
In private with a subordinate who worked for... the court.
Correct.
Where he was the judge.
100% correct.
That entirely private?
Well, it's private in the sense that the public's not exposed to any of it. It was just between the two of them. That's what I mean by that. A lot of this misconduct, especially the ones that were judges are, you know, getting removed for activities on the bench, this is totally like the Russo case. You know, this is something that happens in, or Falcone, I think, for that matter, part of it. But Russo's the best example of that, where it's you've got a judge on the bench saying the most ridiculous, offensive, inappropriate things that the judiciary and the public have a right to expect better of our judges.
Mr. Ramsey, this isn't a question of your fine advocacy.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
This is not a question of your fine advocacy, and I understand fully why you would look back in time to precedents to argue, including from dated cases that, mm-hmm. that were decided 20, 30 years ago. We rely on your book as well and cite it throughout the state.
That's nothing to be proud of, Your Honor.
And have it. So this is not about collecting past matters. The question is, how do we deal with change? And there are cases where this court has chosen to set a different course based on matters that have come before it without relying on prior matters. The reference earlier to the Cohen matter was one example about counsel involved in child pornography, where the court imposed a much lengthier sentence, an indefinite suspension, and put the bar on notice that even more serious consequences could follow in similar type cases in the future. Same with in the matter of William Torrey, where an attorney who took money, who borrowed money from an elderly vulnerable client without a third party providing advice or consent and harming the client, the court said, no, we are imposing a more serious period of suspension, and counsel should be on notice for the bar as a whole, that in the future, there may be yet more serious matters. And my question is it time now to deliver a similar notice to all judges that conduct of the type that we have here, of the facts that are not in dispute, that a judge touched without consent in an intimate area while having provided alcohol to the individual who was then drunk, a subordinate, that has no place in the judicial system?
It doesn't.
And that a judge should not, and I put this to you, should not expect to be able to come back after 120 or 240 days and continue to serve on the bench.
But Your Honor, how is that fair, though, to the respondent here who would have no way of anticipating that? May I just...
Please.
I want to talk about this because the Attorney General brought this up in her very fine brief, and I kind of agree with her. I want to talk about Seaman and Sobrian, these two disgraceful cases, each of whom wound up getting a 60-day suspension from practice and or from the judicial duties. And I teach these classes all the time. And one of the things I do to my students is I go around the room and I said, who had a judicial clerkship? And I call them and say, tell all the other students about your judicial clerkship. And invariably, they say it was the best experience of my life. I learned more as a clerk in the year I was there than I did in the last 15, 20, 30, 40 years of the practice of law. They describe it as a wonderful, wonderful time in their lives. And it's very gratifying to hear. And I get that story constantly from all of my students. And when I think about how the lives of these two young women were ruined and sabotaged for no reason at all because of the sexual perversion of these two judges in Seaman and Sobrian, and how their lives were ruined, how what should have been the happiest time of their professional lives was turned into the worst time of their professional lives. I'm not quite sure what the court had in mind back in 1993, for example, when the Sobrian case came. And I agree with the Attorney General's position. These cases, if they came before the court today, probably should be disbarment, or not disbarment, but removal cases.
Sobrian was 2006, no?
I'm sorry?
Sobrian, 2006.
I don't know. I thought it was 93, but I know it was 13 years after the Seaman case.
So Seaman was 1993. And I think the facts of Seaman are important for this very conversation. Mm-hmm. There we had a judge sexually harass a female law clerk over the period of several months, suggested having sex on his desk, attempted to put the clerk's hand on his private parts, improperly touched her under her skirt, and got a 60-day suspension.
Correct.
Is it within the remote realm of possibility that would be mated out as the appropriate outcome today? Mm-hmm. And would it be unfair? Could one suggest that no judge could have anticipated that the suspension or removal, the suspension would be far greater, or there might be even more serious consequences if that were being heard 31 years later today?
You know, you're posing a very tough question to me, Your Honor. I think that today, if these cases came before this court, they would likely be removal cases, all right, because it's really outrageous conduct. I'm not quite sure what the court had in mind all those years ago, but it is what it is. But I'm really, I can't be concerned about general public policy. I'm concerned about my client. And it's just a matter of fairness. If the court wants to sort of chart new territory and come up with a new rule of law and put everybody on notice, this is what it's going to be in the future, that's perfectly fine.
And what's the penalty for your client under those circumstances?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And what would your recommendation be for the outcome for your client then?
I thought it should be a censure case, but again, it wouldn't be unreasonable to suspend him for a short period of time either. And, you know, do a written opinion saying this is the last. Anybody who does this in the future can expect removal. All right. But it's, do you, I'm just, it's really just a question of fundamental fairness.
Mr. Ramsey, do you really contend that your client was not on notice that there would be very serious consequences for the conduct?
I don't even think he thought about it. I really don't. But he's going to speak to you in a moment. Maybe he's probably the best one to answer that question.
Well, we're talking about a judge and someone obviously who's had a lot of experience in the law. Are you really telling us that he would not be, would not have been on notice that conduct would have very serious consequences when this was admittedly, because we're dealing with a stipulated set of facts, this was done?
Your Honor, I can't speak for him. Okay. All I can tell you is, you know, what the objective facts are and my advocacy along those lines. So in any event, I've like to have my client address the court just to give a little background about him. He's been practicing law in our state for over 50 years. And these are all mitigating factors that came out of, I think, the Seaman case. He's been a municipal court judge in multiple counties for, I think, between 20, 25 years. He's routinely reappointed in different counties by different governments, notwithstanding the vicissitudes of local politics. I have to tell you, in all honesty, he's universally respected as a wonderful jurist, loved equally by prosecutors, defense attorney, and the general public. He's just an excellent judge and has been for a long, long time. This highly publicized case did not deter the municipalities that employ him from keeping him on. He's been sitting on the bench continuously during this all this time. Most people they can't believe that something like this would happen to him. But I know he wanted to address Your Honor. So,
given that opportunity, I did want to let the Attorney General, if you had rebuttal, now would be the time. And Mr. Ramsey, in fairness, if you need to correct anything, I'll give you an opportunity afterward as well. Anything, Ms. Michaelberg? No? Then we'll hear from Judge
Hoffman. You get the last word today. Come on up here and say hello to everybody. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to hear the case. Let me let you know a little bit about me, which may or may not assist you in making whatever decisions you're going to make. I've been married twice, first time 17 years. Second time, 37 years and still going. I have 6 kids, 4 of which are daughters. I have never had an ethics complaint filed against me that was found for any reason at all in the 52 years that I've been practicing law. I was a little taken aback when they said I was relying on the transcript. I am relying on what the hearing was. I am not stipulating, and I think I put that when we were going, voting the order to show cause coming to the Supreme Court, that I, and this may be semantics, touched her leg. What I did was, a little background on that. She texts me out of the blue, says, "What are you doing?" Sitting on my front porch. She shows up, sits on my front porch with me for about an hour. She then says, "Are we going to have anything to drink?" I then said, "I'd like to show you the house." I show her the house. We then come back and she said, "What are we going to drink?" I have a cabinet. I open the cabinet. I said, "What do you want?" So she picked out a liquor. She also said she wanted, I can't tell you at this point whether it was a beer or a claw or whatever it is that my kids drink. Out of the refrigerator. We're sitting in the living room, which is like a fishbowl. There's windows all around, the door's open. My son's girlfriend is coming in and out of the house with her daughter because she was shopping. My son is replacing a window in the back part of the house, which is like 2 rooms away. She leaves occasionally, comes back, and apparently she was watching the Phillies game. I'm not a baseball fan. And she kept reporting to my son, who is a Phillies fan, the score of the game and everything else. Apparently, when she was going back, she was going to the bathroom and everything else. I poured the first shot, and I opened the refrigerator door and said, "Take what you want." The second, third, and fourth shot, I know exactly how many there were poured by her. And she said, "Get out here and let's have a shot." That's what happened. As far as her knee, I did. I patted her knee, which she said at the hearing was consoling. She then started crying again And I'm sitting in my chair. She's turning sideways. I'm not looking at my hand. And I patted. I suspect it was the inner thigh by the way she was sitting. I didn't rub her leg. I patted her leg to console her because she was crying about something with her boyfriend that doesn't really matter to this court. So I did the knee, patted the, which I guess was the inner thigh, twice, and that was it. She left. She got a ride home from her mother. And I've seen her twice since then. And this was October, 2 years ago. I saw her at the hearing here, and I saw her once in Robbinsville when she was in there as I was sitting on the bench. I have always denied that I was rubbing her leg. I had no intention of rubbing her leg. I had intentions of consoling her. And just so that it's clear, she's wearing dungarees. That's it. Yeah. It's almost like, when did you stop beating your wife? I mean, I didn't do anything. If I was deemed to be flippant at the other hearing, it's because I was asked a question by Mr. Ramsey and I hesitated answering as to whether I thought it was a violation of the canon to have her there drink. I've since found out that absolutely it's a violation of the canon and everything else. But at the municipal court level, the staff, your administrator, and the attorneys who appear in front of you were all relatively close. I don't look at anybody as a subordinate because, number one, I don't really hire them. They get my blessing. My court administrator hires them. They're just people that I know that I deal with on a daily, weekly, whatever court schedule is basis. So I'm not, wasn't looking for a power play. I wasn't looking to do anything of a sexual nature. Again, I got four daughters. And I wasn't looking to get her drunk. I mean, I'm drinking. I'm called into the kitchen three times by her, and I went. I have no idea. I have never been out with this girl other than one Christmas party that I would do for the employees of Robbinsville. I don't know her capacity. I don't know whether she was drunk. And I've said in the transcripts that I've gone through that she did not appear to me to be drunk. She was not slurring. She was going from here to maybe the corner of that table, which is where the door was, and disappeared. So I'm not watching her walk. I'm not watching her stagger. I'm not watching her fall. I didn't see any of that. And I had no idea until I was told afterwards that she was drunk. If you have any questions, feel free.
Judge Hoffman, how did this individual know where your shore house was?
She lives in Beach Haven West. I live in Beach Haven. That's where I have, you know, I'm lucky enough to have a summer home. She had asked me maybe a month or two before that, where do you live? And I gave her the address, and it's not something I hide. I mean, I told everybody what the address is. She drove by the house apparently a week or 2 weeks before that with her mother, so she knew where the house was. And that's, I'm assuming, how she knew how to get there.
When she showed up, were you startled?
No. She texted me. She said, you know, I'm coming to the island. Can I stop by for a visit? And I said, sure. And my shore mentality, which I've turned off, says somebody comes, you have a house at the shore, you entertain them, you say, yeah, you want to stop by, feel free. And she was there 4 or 5 hours. The first hour was sitting on the front porch. I didn't know that she planned to stay that long, nor did I know that she planned to listen to a Phillies game.
Judge, did the ACJC find in its presentment that you touched her inner thigh without consent?
I had problems with the wording because I know at one point it said if you have the order show cause and you can have a separate hearing, you can test the facts. I'm not contesting what they found. I am contesting that it was a pat as opposed to a rub. I mean, they're saying that it went from her knee up, you know, wherever. I didn't do that.
Did they make that finding?
Did they? No.
What did they find with respect to the second touch?
That the finding that I read in the decision was that I was rubbing her inner thigh. And did I pat her inner thigh? Yes.
And you're disputing their finding that you rubbed her inner thigh?
Absolutely.
My understanding from letters leading up to this, when you waived the hearing that the court had set in motion before another panel, was that you were not to dispute, you were not challenging the findings of fact and misconduct contained in the presentment.
If you read the letter setting this up for the court, it was very specific, and I told Mr. Ramsey to be very specific, that I am not admitting that I rubbed her leg. I am admitting that I patted her leg twice. And I clarified it in the letter because he said we accept the findings of the lower thing. I didn't accept that finding because it didn't happen.
Did you agree not to object to the court's ability to find, beyond a reasonable doubt, that there is cause for removal on the basis of the existing record?
I agreed to have a hearing in front of the court so that point could be clarified. I did not agree that I was rubbing her thigh. That's in my head.
You agreed that you patted her inner thigh.
Absolutely. Two pats and done. And that was more of a consoling nature than anything else because she's crying on my couch, complaining about her boyfriend. And that was after the knee. It didn't go from the knee to the thigh. Couple pats on the knee, couple pats on the thigh, and that was it.
I don't have the letter in front of me right now, but I do recall, and we will go back to the premise for the court agreeing not to conduct an additional hearing that it had set in motion. My recollection was that although you disagreed that there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt, you did not disagree that there was a basis for the court to make such a finding with respect to the misconduct found by the ACJC.
If I were to agree that there is a basis under a presumption doctrine, that doesn't mean that I agree that all the facts were correct.
If the letter says what my recollection is, and it could be faulty, are we beyond that?
I know what the letter should have said, and I know what I believe the letter did say. Whether I got a copy of it or not, I don't know. But if I did not, I was very careful when I was dealing with Mr. Ramsey as far as what I would consent to or not. The hearing was fine. I mean, we went through investigators, we went through a hearing, everybody testified. But if you look at the language that should have been in there, Mr. Ramsey's letter, I believe I made a distinction.
Here's what the letter says, and you're copied on this letter, dated July 25th, 2024. Respondent acknowledges, and for the purpose of this proceeding, will not challenge the findings of fact and misconduct contained in the ACJC's presentment.
That's not my understanding what the letter was, but if that's what the letter was, that's what the letter was.
And the finding, I'm looking at page 13, one of the findings of the presentment is that, referencing the extended summary contained, these circumstances, respondents drinking alcohol liberally with LW and touching her inappropriately, the latter without her consent and in a manner that may reasonably be construed as sexual in nature, coupled with respondents' attempts during these proceedings to portray LW's offense at misconduct as the perception of a muddled mind, .. These are the findings of the ACJC that you did not challenge.
I must have misread the letter. And I guess I'm stuck with, you know, what we have here today, but that doesn't mean that I'm not denying I touched her thigh. I'm saying I patted her thigh after I patterned her knee.
There was no fight. I'm sorry. The ACJC, you're saying, did find that it was not a pat and that instead it was a rub?
I believe from all the transcripts that I've read, it was said that I went from her knee all the way up her thigh and then rubbed her thigh. The It was asked whether she was wearing a skirt, and he said no, she was wearing dungarees. And what I did do is I patted her knee. Mr. Ramsey asked her if that was consoling, given what she was telling me, and she said yes. I then also admit that I patted her thigh because she got upset again. Same thing. Now, I don't know. I didn't look down to see where I was patting. She's sitting next to me, facing me. Her left leg is cocked. And that's when I went to pat. That was where I went to pat.
Please go ahead.
That was it. I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to everyone. We will take the matter under advisement.